My name is Full On Gamer, and I am a Game On minion.
D20 Radio, your gamer's role. www.d20radio.com.
Game on. Welcome to Game On, your D20 radio podcast about all things tabletop gaming related. It is Saturday, January 10th, 2009, and believe it or not, against all odds, this is episode number 4. I'm Brian, known as Fiddleback in the forums. With me today, playing the Harpo and Chico to my Groucho, is my good friend Andy. How do you do, Andy Reno?
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Yet I'm sure not the most ridiculous thing you will hear today so far.
Not at all. Brian, I am so fine. If I turn sideways, you can't even see me.
Oh.
Okay, that's not true. If I turn sideways, I block out the sun. So anyways, I'm doing okay. I'm here. Episode 4. Now, as I recall, in the original trilogy, episode 4 was one of the better episodes, so this might be a good thing.
Yeah, all we need is some guy to come in and breathe deep a lot.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, don't let it be you, please.
Okay.
Yeah, all right. What are we talking about today, Andy?
Well, you know, today's topic, I actually had a little trouble finding today's topic, you know, for the episode, because it's so small. Oh. In fact, you might even call it a miniature episode. Well, an episode about miniatures, at any rate. From those darling little pre-painted plastic collectible minis crafted from the sweat of 3 cent-an-hour Chinese children, God love them, to the soul-sucking, wallet-siphoning, I think I married her, put them together yourself and paint them up miniatures from the companies whose name, whose rhymes, oh, man, the toboggan burst into flames. It's loaded with fuel, and my pants
3 minutes
are on fire. Yeah, 3 minutes. 3 minutes. Yeah, we're doing good.
Try it again.
It was the ex-wife thing.
Uh-huh.
Put them together yourself and paint them up miniatures from the company whose name rhymes with Shames Sporkslop. I think him, too. We give you the ground tour. Ground tour? Grand tour. It'll be on a ground level.
Oh, jeez.
Second floor, housewares.
Oh, I am starting to drinking.
I'm just going to turn my microphone off.
Okay.
Anyways, this episode is going to be about all things miniature related, and it'll have nothing to do with any parts of my anatomy.
Your anatomy? Man, the Gamer Nation is loaded up already.
Oh, yeah. We're, you know, just set up the shots and go for it.
Yeah. Also, we'll be announcing the winner of our contest from episode 2.
Excellent.
We asked you to write.
Stories.
No, walk everywhere. That's fine.
Okay. Well, you know, it's downhill from here. You know,
yeah.
Toboggan's on fire. We're gaining speed. You know, what's the worst could happen? Oh, a tree off the cliff and in front of a log truck. Okay.
Yeah.
Carry on.
We asked you to write into our forums and give us your best board game story. And tonight, Andy and I, if he can stay awake, will pick a winner. So, let's proceed with the show forthwith. Upkeep phase.
Well, Gamer Nation, it's the upkeep phase where we take care of thank yous and get you up to date about what's been going on around the D20 radio network.
First, Thanks go out to Full On Gamer for providing us with today's opening bumper. Takes a brave man to send us their vocal records, but he did it anyway. Now if we can just get tracings of your house key, we'll be all set. Be perfect. I have to say, I really like this bumper. I mean, I know we're not really, you know, we don't really have any minions as such, but still, the idea that we are somehow evil overlords does have its appeal.
Indeed.
Yeah. This might be our winning bumper choice, I think.
I think so. Yeah, it's feeling good. It's got a nice vibe to
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. So if you'd like to, assist us with making the choice, feel free to record that bumper. And in your own voice, of course, because Full On, there's only one of him, and I think that's a good thing.
Probably.
Yeah. And, record it, send it to us, and we'll be sure to play it in the episode. The D20 Radio Network has been hopping quite a bit here lately. I don't know if you've noticed that or not, Andy.
Hopping.
Yeah, hopping, like a frog on a frying pan.
There's... I don't know, it's hopping or popping or what, but yeah, it's jumping around there.
I don't know. There's quite a bit of audio goodness to check out there.
The Order 66 podcast, perhaps some of you out there have heard of this, released episode 49 into the wild, entitled, I Sold My Soul to the CSA. Wasn't that an old song or something?
No.
It deals with a corporate agent prestige class from Star Wars Saga Edition's KOTOR campaign guide. A fine tome.
Indeed.
If your goal in life is to play a corporate tool, and we know it is, give episode 49 a listen. More importantly, tomorrow night, Sunday the 11th, they go live with episode 50. That's right, kids. Order 66 podcast has been coming to you for a year now, and they are celebrating in a big way. They'll have Rodney Thompson, you heard me, Rodney Thompson, developer and designer of Star Wars Saga Edition. Sterling Hershey, the man with the coolest not made up name ever, you wrote that purposely for me, and Sam Witwer, whom you may recognize as the physical embodiment of the only man to give both the Emperor and Darth Vader an atomic wedgie. Vader's secret apprentice in The Force Unleashed. It promises to be a huge show, so tune in and join them in the chat rooms. Just check out Order 66 thread for details.
Meanwhile, the Super Gaming Podcast is up and running, and unless I miss my guess, Mostly Joe should have some new episodes going live within the week. And I don't usually miss my guess. He promises to be talking to Tom Cater, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, of Tom vs. The Flash fame about the speedster archetype, as well as having a special edition interview up with Steve Kenson of Steve Jackson Games, no relation, about the GURPS system. The two Steves aren't related. It's okay. Drive through. So put on your little winged boots and get caught up while you wait for those episodes to break.
Winged boots.
Winged.
Mm-hmm. I gotta get me some of those.
Yeah.
Well, while D&D 4th Edition continues to give us fits, nightmares, and other problems, we have high hopes that if we keep listening to Radio Free Homelet, we may find just the medicine we need to cure our ills. You're so clever.
Mm-hmm.
You will too, especially if you happen to need all the latest tips and tricks.
Drink.
Son of a gun. Wow. For characters in the Forgotten Realms. Episode 12 of Radio Free Homelet deals with the Drow, the Genasi, and the Sword Mage. Sword Mage.
Yeah.
Goodness. For the Forgotten Realms Player's Guide. Tune in and hear what the gang has to say in their latest episode.
Old School and the Ginger Baron have their threat. I love those names. I really do. I'm going to stop reading right now. Old School and the Ginger Baron.
Yes.
It's like the Cinnamon Count. Old School and the Ginger Baron have their thread up and active in the forums now. If you like Warhammer Fantasy,
I'm not the only one, Gamer Nation. I'm not the only one. I know it seems like it. It really does. But every now and then, I get to use the brain, and, you know, his inn shuts down, so.
Yeah, well, you see, what the thing is I'm the social drinking game. You're the hardcore alcoholic drinking game.
A distinction I shall carry proudly.
Indeed. If you like Warhammer Fantasy role-playing, their small but vicious podcast will help you feed your fix. Drop them a line in the forums and tell them what you want to hear. While you're at it, check out the episodes they've done already on iTunes by searching for the Small But Vicious podcast. Welcome to the network, boys.
Small but vicious.
Yeah. Probably froth at the mouth a little bit, too.
Oh, this next announcement goes out to everybody, especially me, but, you know, everybody in general. Are you running around naked, Gamer Nation? Well, put a shirt on. Nobody wants to see that. In fact, put on a D20 Radio Network t-shirt from Nick at Crazy Custom Tees. Check out his designs for both the Order 66 and Radio Free Homlet t-shirts. And keep an eyeball peeled. That's one eye open, at least. One of our Game On t-shirts, which, provided GM Chris remembers to send us the info, may be coming to Nick's store soon. Sooner would be better than later, but, you know, we'll take what we can get at this point. Just follow the D20 Radio swag thread and see what Nick's got for you.
All this and more is available at www.d20radio.com. Just follow the links off the front page to access all these fine shows. And if you want to hang out with us and tell us your latest game stories, follow the community forums link and give us a holler. Bits and Pieces.
Well, it's time for Bits and Pieces, featuring news from around the gaming world, sifted, filtered, shaken, not stirred, just for you, Gamer Nation.
Speaking of shaken, not stirred, Gen Con LLC announced on January 9th that the U.S. Bankruptcy Court of Western Washington has confirmed the company's plan of reorganization and approved the company's rejection of a hostile takeover bid. Since filing for bankruptcy protection in February of 2008, Gen Con has significantly reduced its expenses and increased its cash position, which I think means they stand a little bit to the left of George Washington's head now. The company's cash flow is positive, and prospects have never looked better. Under the confirmed plan, Gen Con will pay all of its creditors in full over time and will continue to operate. A 3-member advisory committee will assist the company and its board, and Peter Adkinson will retain ownership. That's relatively good news, I suppose, if you're a Gen Con attendee.
Which, I haven't been, so, you know, hope to be sometime, but,
That's all right. Other people are.
I'd like to improve my cash flow thing, stuff, bank account. I opened my wallet the other day, and it went,
yeah.
together.
My cash flow is fine. It's just all going in the wrong direction.
I have that problem frequently. Bombay, a fine gin that we... wrong. Bombay will be the next release from Istari Games, and Istari founder Cyril Demegid. I hope I said that right. If I didn't, well, I apologize, but he'll probably never hear this. The game's designer, when TrickTrack.net, that was a hard one to say, announced the game in early January 2009, the game was described as being Itzari's simplest title yet. The game company and designer notwithstanding. Something that will work for both the general public and experienced gamers. Oh good, something I might be able to play.
Yeah.
Your goal in Bombay is to make more money than other players by selling silk, earning clients, and building palaces. Think of it as another version of a traveling salesman game, but with cute plastic elephants and no farmer's daughters. a change from previous releases. Bombay will be distributed in Germany and the U.S. by Asmodee Games, says Demegid. Asmodee is now our distributor in Germany, as they helped us a lot for the plastic bits and during the quotation process. I thought it was fair to let them distribute the game in the USA. Of course, it doesn't mean I won't work with Rio Grande anymore. Jay is an excellent partner, and we've plenty of projects ahead, but Bombay is an exception. Bombay is for 2 to 5 players with a price of 40 euros. That would be in Europe. And is due to be released in March of 2009.
Awesome. Martin Wallace's Steam Rails to Riches, the redesigned version of Age of Steam, now has a street date of April 2nd, 2009, from Mayfair Games. In Steam, you build railroads and deliver goods along an ever-changing network of tracks and stations. You build the tracks, upgrade towns, improve your train, and grab the right goods to make the longest, most profitable deliveries. Score your deliveries, add to your income or victory points, balancing your need to invest against your quest to win the game, which is what it's all about. Steam contains a beautiful double-sided game board. The map on each side depicts terrain, towns, and cities at the start of the railway age. The map of the northeastern USA and neighboring Canada is ideal for 3 or 4 players. And you use the map of Europe's lower Rhine and Ruhr. I'm hoping there's an H in there that doesn't belong, but that's okay. And Ruhr region when playing a 4 or 5 player game. You can play Steam on any number of current and future variant and expansion maps, so they include pieces for 6 players. Steam is for 3 to 6 players, ages 12 and up, with a playing time of 90 or so minutes, and a price of $55 US. That will be cool.
It will. I'm looking forward to that one. Now, I can not only put it on my calendar, I've got a date of somewhere to put it.
Yes.
Indeed. If you're hungry for more news in the gaming world, including additional details on these stories and more, visit www.boardgamenews.com and www.gamingreport.com, your source for gaming news.
Say, I'm looking for some sort of abstract strategy game, something with possibly parasitic conflict or bidding and economics. Something with majority control and mass marketing. Min-maxing. It'll make people want to run away in fear not playing anything other than rock, paper, scissors. Have you got anything like that?
What the heck did he just say? It's definition time again, Gamer Nation. We don't want you to be hebetudinous or anserine when speaking with others about your love of games. When we push the envelope of games discussion, we want you to at least know where the stamps are. There are, in general, 2 types of miniature or war games.
Indeed. Strategic. Adjective. In a wargaming sense, a large-scale game in which units represent large military formations, brigades and larger, over a wide-ranging area like a nation or continent. Typically, these games have a high level of abstraction and a low level of detail to depict conflict. Such a game depicts an entire war or a major campaign.
Tactical. Adjective. In a wargaming sense, a small-scale game in which units represent small military formations, platoons, squads, or down to a single soldier, ship, tank, or aircraft, over a limited area, such as a city or even a few blocks. Typically, these games have a low level of abstraction and a high level of detail to simulate conflict. Such a game depicts a battle, or part of one, or a skirmish. The games we will look at today fall primarily into the tactical realm. So, let's say we get this show on the road. Miniature games come under the larger heading of war games. War games can feature anything from actual miniatures used to represent your pieces, units, or troops to cardboard counters, or chits, as they're called. Our focus today is going to be on those war games that use actual models of your units. Frequently, you will have a small number of units, generally up to about a dozen or so, and you will be participating in a skirmish or small-scale conflict, thus making them tactical-level fights. Now, understand, Gamer Nation, we haven't played all the various and sundry miniature games that are available out there. There's just no way. However, between the two of us, we've played a fair few. So we aren't going to cover everything, and we'll probably miss a bunch of stuff that you yourself enjoy. But we want to give you an overview of what's out there, and a kind of general guide to what we think of them, and why we do or don't enjoy them. So to begin with, let's take a look at a few of the collectible-style miniature games. And we'll open with WizKids. What do you think, Andy?
Well, yeah, since they kind of kicked the whole collectible pre-painted miniature type thing off, that sounds like a good place to start.
Indeed they did. They created what are called or referred to as Clicks games. Most notably, they started with a game called Mage Knight, which was sort of a fantasy miniatures game. It was kind of, sort of Dungeons & Dragon-ish, but not very much so. And I don't know about you, Andy, but I got in on the ground floor of Mage Knights. I got to play some actual promotional demo games with some guys at our old FLGS.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting concept, as I recall. You had a miniature which was fairly well done. I mean, it wasn't the most brilliant looking thing in the world, but it was at least painted, and you didn't have to, you know, buy paints or extra bits or anything like that. And they sat on this little base, and you could rotate the base every time the unit or figure took damage, and it would give you different stats and different options for abilities and things like that. Unfortunately, my biggest problem with Mage Knight was that I just didn't feel like I was all that interested in their fantasy theme. I didn't have any context for it, and I wasn't really all that into pushing these things around the table like they were. I don't know, did you ever play Mage Knight?
No, I missed Mage Knight. By the time that it came out, I was playing other higher-end miniatures games, and at that point in time, it was beneath me to play such a game.
Oh, so you're one of those, an elitist.
Mm-hmm. Not so much anymore, but at that point, yeah, it just didn't appeal to me. You know, like you said, the fantasy theme back then, a fantasy theme to me, you know, it was Dungeons and Dragons, and if it didn't, you know, wasn't solidified in that type of a setting, it didn't hold as much appeal for me. But it was a very popular game when it first came out.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people went crazy for this thing. I know the two guys I played with in those first couple of sessions weren't all that thrilled with it either, but certainly a huge number of other people were.
Yeah, it had a fairly popular following, and it ran for quite a while.
Yeah. And then, let's see, what was it about, a year later, maybe not even that much, WizKids announced that they had picked up the rights to both Marvel and DC superheroes. And so they produced a new game called HeroClix, which was the same basic concept as Mage Knight was, but it was, of course, superhero-based. Now, that one I was interested in.
I can't imagine why.
Yeah, I don't know. It was strange. Very strange.
You guys wearing your underwear on the outside.
Uh-huh. And anyway, we got into that, and I really enjoyed that. One of our mutual friends, Todd, really got into it as well. And so we organized tournaments and whatnot. To me, the HeroClix game was just faster moving and more, I guess, aggressive and more interesting in terms of, you know, stories and whatnot. Because, of course, I kind of knew all the stories and everything for all the figures. And it did pretty well for a while.
Yeah, well, of course, unfortunately, WizKids has closed their doors, but just here within the last year, I mean, they'd come out with a couple more expansions for it. So it's ran for a long time.
And we were into it. We probably played that thing to death every weekend for a good part of 9 months, I guess. And then their release sets kind of started going downhill. There were a couple of them that we referred to just as the Blades, Claws, Fangs sets. Because that seemed to be almost the only power any of the heroes that they put out had in it.
Right.
And the other problem it kind of suffered from, and I guess some people enjoyed this aspect of it, but I didn't in particular, was that there were 17 or 18 different versions of your Spider-Mans and your Batmans and your Daredevils and your... The really big offender was Elektra. I think Elektra showed up in every set there for a while. She's just not that fun.
Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that didn't appeal to me about HeroClix and to a degree about collectible gaming in particular, when they overproduce something like that, or not necessarily overproduce, but you know, make so many different versions of it, you fall into the trap of going out and having to buy 18 cases, you know, to get all the different kinds of miniatures you want, so you've got all the cool stuff and everything of that nature. And it just, it seemed like it overpopulated a lot of the sets.
Right. And it definitely did. I mean, there were some figures where, while they had different names on the bases, they really weren't all that different.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, a lot of the times, same figure, same paint job, it just had a different base and a different set of stats.
And I'm about to be totally wrong about this, but I think that the Sentinel, the giant Sentinel figure, was the first large size Clicks figure that WizKids did. I could be wrong. It could be one of the Mage Knight, you know, what do you call them things? The Sphinx. Yeah, it might be. But I think the timing was pretty close on both those.
It was pretty close. I know Mage Knight had some figures that had some fairly large bases to them, much larger than the standard Clicks base. But yeah, one of the biggest ones that ever came out, I believe, was the Sentinel.
Yeah. And that was a lot of fun. We played a couple of tournaments against that. And I just, on the whole, I just liked Heraclix way more than I liked the Mage Knight stuff. Because, like I said before, it was just faster. It seemed like it was a faster operating game. And the maps, I thought, were more appropriate to it as well. So I enjoyed playing that way.
Yeah, well, and that was kind of neat. One of the neat things about the Heraclix is they came out with map packs, and they had accessories that you could put on the maps and, you know, use them as weapons or use them as cover and things of that nature, giving the game more of a three-dimensional feel because your maps were flat and, you know, just printed on paper. Whereas with a lot of other types of miniature games, you have actual buildings and trees and hills and things of that nature. So it added to it.
Right. Right. And then something amazing happened. MechWarrior Clicks.
Yes.
Just incredible stuff. I got into that so far that I actually signed up on the WizKids site to run the tournaments and whatnot and get all the prize support and all that stuff. And I ran a MechWarrior League for about a year, I guess. And, of course, you know, it's the giant robots and the whole nine yards there. And MechWarrior, they added an extra dial on the base, which was to manage your heat for your for your mech and whatnot. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was one of the Click games that I really enjoyed. I didn't start playing it until later on when it had already been out for a year or two. But I'd always been a fan of the BattleTech universe, which that played heavily on a lot of the same mechs and things of that nature. So that one really appealed to me. And yeah, the heat dial is as big an enemy as anything else on the battlefield, because that'll kill a mech just as quick as anything.
Yep. And I actually got to play against the big Click for MechWarrior, which was the dropship.
The dropship. That thing was huge.
Yeah. That was very cool. I got to run that against six guys. I won.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, let's send one lance against a dropship. I don't think so.
It was very, very cool. WizKids' next offering, I believe it was their next offering, was Crimson Skies, which had a unique distribution method, at least at the time for collectible games. You could buy an entire faction in one box. And that made it a lot easier to get the pieces you wanted in the way you wanted, and made a whole lot more sense, and so naturally, it didn't go very far.
Yeah, and that was the unfortunate thing about it, because Crimson Skies was actually a very nice little game. The background setting for it was kind of an alternate universe pulp type of late 30s, leading into World War II alternate universe type of thing. Everything, you know, instead of, you know, everybody owning a car, everybody owns an airplane type of thing, and you have sky pirates and things of that nature. And that was what appealed to me about Crimson Skies, was I knew what I was going to buy. All I had to do was go look at the blister pack, and I go, oh, it's got these shiny planes in it, that's what I want to play. But that was part of its shortcoming, was they only made about 7 or 8 total blisters with 4 miniatures in each blister. And it didn't perpetuate the game any further than that.
Right. Apparently it didn't do as well as they were hoping. Although, one of the neat things about it was, in addition to the Clicks dials and all that stuff, you had to plot your flight path.
Yes.
And you had these little hexagons that you would lay down, and in response to a, you know, whatever card you were going to play for your path, you'd lay down the hexes in the appropriate pattern, and that would tell you where you were going to fly and where you ended up. This resulted in numerous people flying directly into the side of a building. Which is, of course, my favorite victory method. I would rather win because you screwed up. Because it just makes it all that much more sweeter.
Yes. So when your opponent says, I'm going to pull off an ill one, and he flips over and runs into the Sears Tower, yeah, it's priceless.
Yeah, that was very cool. And I can't tell you how many games were conceded just because the other guy didn't know how to plot his path. Fly off the table, fly into the buildings, crash and burn, and oh, look, Brian won again. I only fired 2 shots, but I won.
Hey.
Yeah.
One of the last ones to come out from WizKids was the Halo Clicks version, which, of course, is based on all the Halo characters and things of that nature, and plays very much like any of the other Clicks games. You have the rotating dial on the base to take your damage and things of that nature. You have a couple of dice that you use to make your attack and defense rolls and things of that nature. And that was, wouldn't even really call it a flash in the pan. I think that was just a jump on the bandwagon. Oh, God, look how cool Halo 3 is going to be. We need to crank something out and you know, flood the market with this. But
right.
it was an addition to the series.
And I could be wrong about this, but as I recall, the one game of Halo Clicks I played, it seemed like it was a much more... what's the word I want to look for here? Programmed, I guess, kind of game. You didn't seem like you had as many options as you did with like HeroClix or some of the others.
Well, it was kind of hampered by the type of characters and stuff that you had, because of course everybody wanted to play the Master Chief or the Arbiter or something of that nature, and you could indeed do that, but you had to have other characters in there to flesh out your army and stuff, and you had a number of points with which to do that. I think it might have seemed programmed because everybody kind of had the same general idea of what they were going to do and didn't put much tactical consideration into it. It was pretty much a run up and just smash the opponent in the face type of thing because, after all, you are the Master Chief. So.
Right. And they did a number of other Clicks games. We're not going to cover all the little Clicks games that WizKids did. I mean, they had like baseball Clicks and a couple other things. But we do want to touch on Pirates of the Spanish Main, which was not a Clicks game. It was the first, what they called, constructible miniature game, or pretty close to the first, anyway. There might have been one more ahead of it. But Pirates of the Spanish Main took off like nobody's business.
Yeah, that thing, it caught on fire worse than my toboggan ever thought about, mm-hmm. and it burned for quite a while.
Yeah, but it you know, reasonably so, too, because it was a fun game to play.
It was, it really was, and it was one of those strange things where, you know, I saw it at the game store, and I thought, who would want to build a little tiny pirate ship and you know, put it on the table and play with it? And, you know, hope against hope, I, you know, broke down and bought a pack. And after that, you know, second mortgage on the house, I had about 1,000 pirate ships at home. So.
Yeah, I've got a bucket around here somewhere
with a couple of buckets at least. Yeah, but it was a good little game, and it was simple. It was mm-hmm. it was fast moving, and it was simple, and I think that was what really attracted a lot of people to it, especially younger kids.
Right. You wouldn't have really terrain as such, but you would lay out on the table these little islands, and the object was to like run over to the island, collect the treasure, and try to get it back to your home port before your opponent sailed over and blew the snot out of you.
That would happen frequently.
Yeah. And sometimes the object of the game was just to blow the snot out of people, you know. But it was hella fun. And it kept very simple because all your measurements were done right off the card that your pirate ship came on.
Uh-huh.
And you could add crew to customize your ship and various little abilities and everything. It was just a lot of fun to play and really enjoyable, like you said, very quick. You could get into it in a matter of moments and complete a game in, you know, maybe 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah, and then one of the things that was neat about it is one of their claims on the packaging was, you know, everything you needed to play was in one pack.
And it was, because they'd throw two very tiny little dice.
You got two ships, you got the tiny little dice to go with it. There was an island in there for your terrain and stuff like that.
Yep.
You just pop them out, build them, and you could play a game right there.
Yeah, it was awesome fun. So, as you mentioned earlier, the problem with all these games is WizKids is now out of business.
Yes.
And I think one of the leading factors for that is because with all these games, at least all the main ones, Mage Knights and HeroClix, I don't know that they necessarily did this with Pirates of Spanish Main. If they did, they did it after I got out of the game and whatnot. But with Mage Knights and HeroClix, they did some pretty severe rules reboots.
Yeah, midstream.
Yeah. Mage Knight, they completely wiped out, I think, their first two editions of the game with one of their rules reboots, because they just said, okay, all that stuff, that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, which, if I'm playing a game like that, ticks me off, because I've spent all this money on their product, and now they're telling me I can't use it.
Yeah.
And if you're playing in tournaments and things of that nature that they're supporting, you can't play in it anymore using that particular those particular models.
Right.
You've got to go buy more stuff. So,
which essentially means your first house payment was entirely wasted.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's part of, I think, part of what led to WizKids' demise. But let's pretend that you want to get a hold of some of this stuff. You want to get a hold of Mage Knight, HeroClix, Mech Warrior, Crimson Skies, Pirates of Spanish Main, all that stuff. What can we do, Andy?
Well, I'll tell you. There's a neat little thing on the interwebs called eBay. And there is tons of this stuff out there available. And even if you go down to your local game store, you may be able to find some of this stuff still sitting on their shelf or possibly on a clearance shelf. Because there was a lot of this stuff out there, and especially over the last, it's been about a year or so since I was in the business, but they were pumping out Pirates of the Spanish Main stuff, tying into the Disney movies and things of that nature. And just, I mean, there was a new set coming out every couple of months for it, so there's just, I know there's a bunch of that stuff still sitting out there.
Yeah.
And you could probably get into these games really cheap. I know, like I said on one of the last casts, I picked up 7 packs of Crimson Skies miniatures for like $20 off of eBay.
Yeah.
And that's just a steal compared to what they used to retail for. So.
Yeah, that's absolutely a great deal. And you can get, you know, you can buy them in lots of commons, you can buy rares individually, and I think most of them are still fairly reasonably priced. Some of the rares are going to, ultra rares and rares are going to be ridiculous seeming in price, but you can still put together a pretty good squad just with the commons and the uncommons, and you know, have fun that way. It'll be in the long run, I think, a lot cheaper than the original purchases were. So that's,
yeah, and it's funny because the frustrating thing for me with the Clix games is I didn't know what I was going to get in the packaging. But that was part of the draw of the Pirates game, because it was like, you know, bubblegum cards or something of that nature. You couldn't wait to open up their pack and see what you had in there. So
yeah,
it's kind of a flip-flop thing there, and it always surprises me when I go back and think about that. I used to hate that about collectible games, is because you didn't know what you were going to get. But, you know, in certain cases, that's kind of the draw of it.
Definitely. So the next company we want to talk about in terms of collectible miniature games is Wizards of the Coast.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, 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 yeah. Their first offering from Wizards of the Coast was Dungeons & Dragons Minis.
I've never heard of that game.
You've never heard of that game. I can't imagine how that could be even slightly possible. I think you're lying.
Well, you know, possibly.
Lying like a cheap toupee. All right, so Dungeons & Dragons Minis, which was obviously based on the whole Dungeons & Dragons universe.
You think?
I think. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
These did not have click spaces. There was nothing particularly special about the way they were manufactured, except the fact that they were plastic miniatures on a base, and all their stats and abilities were on separate cards. And you basically just run these things around, fight them against each other. You could have your dragons fighting your kobolds, fighting your, you know, dwarves, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. They basically tried to cover, and are still trying to cover, everything in all the monster manuals and make them available to you, plus the character classes and different character builds and things like that. I like Dungeons & Dragons. I really do. In spite of everything I've ever said about 4E. I really like Dungeons & Dragons. It's the role-playing game I grew up on. But I didn't like Dungeons & Dragons minis.
Really?
I didn't. And I'm hard-pressed to say exactly why I didn't. There was just something about it that didn't feel like what I wanted Dungeons & Dragons to feel like.
Well, I think part of that has to do with they've taken all of this stuff out of D&D and, for lack of a better term, miniaturized it, and shrunk the game down so much that they've taken a lot of the element of the role-playing out of it. You're not doing any role-playing. It's all small-level skirmishes. And you know it's a combat phase in a role playing game, mm-hmm. but there's no role playing element to it.
Right. There wasn't a particular reason why all these things were fighting together or against each other or anything
right.
like that.
There was no story to drive why the battle was occurring.
Right. You could a lot of the squads didn't make any sense. That people came up with. You'd have things like four or five kobolds. Marching around give me a good one here. Marching around with like a troll or whatever the hell I can't even remember if they made a troll. Anyway, the squads didn't make sense with what was going on in the game. I mean, sure, you were supposed to build a squad based on their alignment, so that technically all the figures kind of worked together. But I don't know. It was just weirdness. I couldn't get my head around why these things, and I was looking for that reason. Why are all these things fighting together, you know? I know, it's a ridiculous point of view to take when you're talking about miniatures and that kind of stuff, but, you look at some of the other miniatures games, and at least it made sense, you had the good guys versus the bad guys, and you had, you'd have, like, for like, MechWarrior, you had factions, that actually made sense. You had, like, the Red Dragon and the wolves and all this. It made kind of sense why they were fighting against each other. But a lot of times the combinations you would see in Dungeons & Dragons minis would be things like, you'd go, well, these guys aren't going to get along anyway. Why are they fighting me? They could be fighting each other.
Yeah, that was the unfortunate thing about it. I mean, it's still a popular game, but I think it's popular for other reasons besides just the miniatures game. Yeah, a lot of the armies that you saw put together would never happen. So, I mean, of course it's in a fantasy realm, so, yeah. Who's to say what would or wouldn't happen. But looking at it from a D&D standpoint, a lot of these things would never show up in a battle, especially fighting together. So,
right. So that was kind of a ding against it for me. That, and it seemed almost too fiddly. There were too many options in terms of powers and things that a given figure could do, and I don't know. It just didn't hit me in the right place. I don't have an exact concrete reason for that. It just didn't hit me in the right way.
Yeah, it was quite popular when I had my store and we ran tournaments and stuff for it, and it was a lot of fun. But compared to some of the other games, it was lacking in the elements that tied the game together. However, on the flip side of that coin, there is the fact that the miniatures are nice to have for games of D&D.
Right, and it's very nice to have the ability to sit down at a table with an adventure, and if you're fighting four ogres, plop down four ogres and have them look like ogres and be ogres, And then be able to kind of find a character that fit your general concept of what your player character was like was nice. Unfortunately, the difficulty is this is a collectible game. So there's no guarantee that when you open a pack, you're going to get what you want. And one of the suggestions that I have made for quite a while, and not to course to anybody who could do anything about it, was that Wizards should really package like a deluxe version of their adventures, where you get the adventure book plus all the minis you need to run that adventure. And I've made this suggestion for a number of years. And just recently, Wizards made an announcement that they were going to do something similar to this, although I don't remember exactly what they called it. They would be packaging miniatures for a given adventure together in one set. So hopefully they'll continue with that.
Yeah, that would That would be much more helpful, I think, especially with the new 4th edition rules. I think that could really play in with a lot of things that they're doing now. So they could really, I think they could expand their reach on the miniatures gamers. Because I know a lot of role players who don't particularly like to use miniatures, don't like to use, you know, any props of any sort other than the map that they're playing on. And then there's some other gamers like myself, I really like to have that kind of stuff. Even if it's just my character, you know, out on the map just to give myself a representation. It's not just a plain old pawn from, you know, an old Sorry game. You know, it's actually my Elven Ranger, so.
Right. And when I learned to play D&D, that's the way we played it. It was all in your head. You had better be able to use your imagination and picture what was going on, where it was going on, what was happening, who was doing what in your head, or you weren't going to be able to play very well.
Yeah, and that's the big thing of role playing is it uses your imagination. You create these realms in your head. It plays through your mind as, you know, like you're watching a movie or you're participating in this battle. And that's one of the things that I love about role playing. But I also like to have, you know, the miniature representation sometimes. To me, it helps me focus a little bit more on it.
Right. Now, Dungeons & Dragons Minis is not the only miniatures game that Wizards of the Coast made. They made Star Wars miniatures. These I like. I like Star Wars miniatures.
I can't imagine why.
Well, you know, and it's not really anything to do with the fact that it's Star Wars.
Oh, come on now.
No, I'm serious. To
just
me,
made a little bit Star Wars?
Well, a little bit, but not this isn't the main reason. Uh-huh. To me, Star Wars minis play cleaner and faster and make more sense than the Dungeons & Dragons minis do.
They really do. There's, I mean, you still have options on your miniatures. As to what they can do, you know, they can shoot or they can throw a grenade or you know, use their lightsaber, whatever. But yeah, I have to agree, the Dungeons & Dragons miniatures seem to get a little more bogged down with having a little bit too much going on instead of being just an out-and-out skirmish miniatures type of game. There was a lot more rules and things thrown at you to bog things down. Yeah, the Star Wars, it goes much quicker, it's clean. It's very straightforward, and for me, it's Star Wars. So,
yeah, and nothing really beats fielding a squad of stormtroopers, and just seeing them on the map. You know, 20 or 30 stormtroopers on the map,
and eliminating as many gun as possible.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Woohoo! Misa gonna die now.
Yeah, you are. Especially if I get a couple of combined fire shots in there.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, Star Wars miniatures to me is probably the better of the two, what do you want to call it, squad-based miniature games
yeah.
that Wizards of the Coast makes. However, having said that, there's a third miniatures game that Wizards of the Coast made.
Oh, there couldn't possibly
there,
be.
There is. And this, to me, and I know I'm going to catch flack for this, and people are going to write in and yell at me and all kinds of neat junk. To me, Star Wars Starship Battles is the pinnacle of Wizards of the Coast minigames.
Yeah, and I really wish that they would have expanded upon this game, because it is indeed a lot of fun, and there is nothing cooler than having a large table set up. And you and I actually got to play this game on TV one night
yeah.
when we had a crew down at my store.
Yeah, I remember that.
We had a huge 4x8 table with a star map set up on the table, and we had, you know, the Empire on one side, the Rebel side on the others, and just tons and tons of starships, star destroyers, frigates, cruisers, you know, everything that you can imagine out there doing battle with one another. And it was just this, it really gave you the sense of scale that some of the battles in Star Wars do for you.
Yeah, it plays on a huge map. I mean, there's no two ways about it. But it just, there's something about seeing squads of X-Wings flying in against squads of TIE Fighters and watching them mix it up and shoot at each other and do the whole, you know, just everything you see them do in the movie and picturing that in your head while you're looking at the minis laid out. It's like you're not so much part of a little squad like you would be with Star Wars miniatures. It's like you're commanding the entire fleet.
Right.
You know, and on that scale, it was awesome the first time I played it, and it has remained awesome all the way through it because I like being in control.
Yes, Gamer Nation, for those of you who haven't quite figured it out yet, Brian is a control freak.
That's right. And I don't care if it's a trap, I'm still going to shoot it. No, but the starship battles, just, I love everything about it. I love the way it works. I love little command cards, little commands you can give out. I love the way the ships work. People complain that, you know, you never really get to use big ships like the Super Star Destroyer and the Mon Calamari Cruiser and all that stuff. You never really get to use those. But Andy, how many times have I wiped you out with those?
Can we not talk about this? No, it's not. It's okay. The Super Star Destroyer is the flaming Dorito from hell in that game.
Mm-hmm.
It is a tough nut to crack. It really is. Yeah, it is so cool because you get one of those out there, and you get a couple of Interdictor class starships out there, and you get the gravity wells going, and stuff just starts to happen.
That's right. I have not. I think I can honestly say I have not played one bad game of Starship Battles.
I don't think so, and it has a lot to do with, you know, the fact that it is Star Wars, but it's also the fact that the game does play well, and it, I mean, in our opinion, I thought it played very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people had complaints, not necessarily that they didn't get to use the big starships, but they couldn't use enough of them. And believe me, one Star Destroyer is more than you want out on the table at any given time.
Yeah, you get the Executor out there, and things are going to go bad for whoever you're playing against.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so that kind of covers the Wizards of the Coast line of things. We want to touch real briefly on a couple of new ones that have come out, new collectible mini games that have come out. And the first one we want to touch on is from Privateer Press, and it's Monster Apocalypse. And I think you've heard us talk about this before on previous casts. This is one we're still checking this out. We haven't played, I think, but one or two games of it. So there's still some room for us to kind of feel along and see where we're going and see how it all works. But so far, I like it.
Yeah, it's Godzilla, Ultraman, and anything else that you can think of from the Saturday afternoon Japanese kaiju movies thrown out onto the gaming table, and you're knocking down buildings and you're kicking tanks and, you know, just beating up on one another. And it is just so far, I mean, like, yeah, we've only played a couple of games, but it's a lot of fun. The premise behind it is just brilliant.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it the couple of times we've gotten to play it, and it makes me want to come back and keep trying it until we get it right, because there's no doubt about it, we played it wrong both the times we played it. But
undoubtedly, but yeah.
Yeah, that's what happens. But we want to come back to this one and keep trying it, and probably we're going to both end up sinking a lot more money into this bad boy.
Let's not. I've already spent a lot on that game. That's my problem with any type of game, but especially collectible games. I have no self-control.
Right, and neither do I. And let me just clarify that treating full-size board games as if they're collectible board games does not help.
Yeah.
Okay, and the next one we want to touch on, and we're only touching on this because it seems to have some sort of following going on right at the moment, and it's fairly new, and that's from Upper Deck, the World of Warcraft minis.
Okay, that's enough touching on that one.
Yep, I touched it, and I don't want the lawsuit now. Okay,
I was very disappointed with this one. I'm remiss to say this, but I do still play the World of Warcraft video game on the computer from time to time.
Yeah.
And that was really the only reason I went out and bought the starter set of this game, because I was hoping for, you know, something to tie in with a miniatures board game type of thing, mm-hmm. and hoping to have a little bit of that translate onto the tabletop instead of off of my laptop, and it just didn't quite work.
Right. And let's sum up our review of the World of Warcraft minis in this way. Andy was able to return the unopened boosters.
For Monster Apocalypse boosters.
Yes, in favor of Monster Apocalypse boosters.
Yeah, I still have a starter set out there. If anybody's interested in it, I'll let it go real cheap.
Yeah.
Other people out there may like the game, and if they do, that's great. If you enjoy playing a game, by all means, play it. Don't not play it just because we don't like it. That's our opinion, and we're entitled to it, and you know we'll beat you over the head with it. But yeah, I did not care for the game.
Yeah. There were other reasons, but the single biggest factor in this game that really ruined my ability to enjoy the game was having to pick up the miniatures two or three times each to make some sort of adjustment, either damage or time or whatever, to the mini, because they are on a sort of a clicks base almost.
Yeah, and it's not just one, there's two dials on these bases.
Yeah. And you gotta handle every mini multiple times, and I didn't want to do it.
It just wasn't well thought out, in my opinion. I think they really rushed through it. I don't think they did enough play testing with it. You know, on another note, I wasn't really impressed with the painting on the figures. You know, there's a lot of things that I just didn't care for about it. It just fell very flat for me, and I was disappointed with it. But like I say, if there's people out there enjoy it, by all means, play it.
Yeah, certainly give it a try. Just be aware, you know, buy a starter first. And then, you know, if you like it, go out and buy boosters.
Yeah, don't buy a starter and four or more boosters like somebody we know did.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was smart enough to only open the starter set. So.
Right. Okay, so that's the collectible mini side of things. And let's look at the non-collectible games, the non-collectible miniature games.
Oh, sure. Go ahead and open up this little chest of my past.
Okay, well, this is where you kind of get to take over the show, because I don't play a lot of these myself.
Oh, sure. Everybody gets to know what a freak I really am. On the side of non-collectible war games, one of the biggest names in the industry is probably Games Workshop. And whenever I hear that name, my sphincter, my wallet, my credit card all tighten up just a little bit. Simply because of the sheer amount of cash I've dropped on their product over the years. I've been playing Warhammer 40K for, coming up on, 12, 13, 14 years now. And I've spent a bucket of money on their games. This is not to say that their products are bad. They have some of the finest models that you will find in the industry. They have some fairly good rule sets out now that make things a little more streamlined than they have been in the past. I can think back to the days of the second edition of 40K, where it was just an exercise in futility of trying to figure out everything that made the game work. It has come a long way over the years. So it's one of the games that I don't play as much as I used to, but I've still got, a closet full of little men.
Yeah, Games Workshop stuff, especially the Warhammer lines, are the things that I would wander into a game shop and I would see people playing, and I would go, "Cool, this looks fun," and then I would go look at prices, and I would look at all the extra stuff you had to do, like the paints and the assembly and all that other stuff, and then I would look again at the people playing and realize just how many of these miniatures they had on the table to play the game. And I would do the math. I have never made that much money in my life. Ever. For anything.
Well, it's if you just sign on the dotted line in blood and hand over your soul, it's not nearly as painful as you might think.
But I like my soul.
What does it do? It just sits there. Come on, put it to work.
Yeah, I know. I could not justify the entry cost to this game. If it had been cheaper to get into the game and to get something I could play with competitively, I might have gone for it. But every starter box I looked at and looked at the figures in, it wasn't that difficult to tell that, No, this was not going to be enough.
Yeah, and that's an unfortunate thing about the fantasy version of Warhammer, the 40K, and even the Lord of the Rings game that they produce. The games are a lot of fun to play, but to, like you say, to get in and to be competitive and play in the big tournaments and stuff like I've done, I mean, I've traveled, you know, all over the place to go to their grand tournaments. I've gone to conventions and things. And, you know, you've got to have quite literally hundreds upon hundreds of dollars worth of miniatures, and then putting in the hours upon hours of time of building them and painting them and doing all the detail work to them that they, you know, they want you to do. That's building and painting is as much of the hobby as the game is, and even more so for some people. But yeah, that can be a very large stumbling block for a lot of people. It has gotten a little bit better over the last couple of years. They have come out with a better variety of starter box sets that come with what they call two complete armies, and it's more like two 500 point forces, and in especially in fantasy, but in Warhammer 40K, 500 points is a very, very small skirmish level battle. In fantasy, it's even smaller, because fantasy is a very large scale, vast numbers of troops type of game. It looks fantastic when it's set up on the gaming table, but yeah, if you stop long enough to think about how much you've sunk into it, it'll give you a brain cramp.
Yeah. Now, okay, so that's my, what do you want to call it, barrier to entry, and your kind of overview. But how do the games actually played? Are they fairly easy to pick up, or am I talking like I'm going to need a college course to get this thing figured out?
No, actually, the thing that can be that can put some people off is if you go out and buy just the core rule book to read through this and see what it's going to take to play. Some of the core rule books are 400 some odd pages, and just looking at the book in the shrink wrap, you're like, dear God, it's a phone book, not a rule book. But one of the great things that Games Workshop does is puts hundreds and hundreds of hours into the background stories and the story and the flavor text of all of the units and the armies and the special characters. They have some of the most fantastic artwork you will ever see. All of the books have modeling guides, painting guides, things to help you, you know, build your models, get them painted, and, you know, out onto the table. But as far as how they play, no, they are not very hard to play. As far as just picking up the main rules, getting the basic rules down. There's always a starter set of rules to go with that just gets you into the game, and then you can add in your special rules and your special characters and, you know, the fancy war machines and things of that nature. So, I mean, you can start out slow and ramp up on it, but that can't be a drawback, is the pricing.
All right. We, over here in the States, we got Warhammer Fantasy, we got Warhammer 40K. For a while, we had, what, Mordheim?
Yeah, Mordheim was a squad-level skirmish fantasy type of thing, which was a play off of the 40K universe version, which, you know, I knew until just a second ago, and my brain went dead. Necromunda. Which took place in the Underhive, which was just the worst place anywhere in the universe to be brought up and raised. There was just all kinds of terrible, bad things that could happen to you in the Underhive. And in Necromunda, you played a gang member. And generally, these games took place with between 5 and 10 miniatures. The thing about this game was it was more along the lines of role-playing, to where your models or your characters could actually level up. You would gain experience points, and they could get new traits and, you know, upgrade weapons and things of that nature. At the end of each game, depending on whether you won or lost, you had income, and you had to feed your gang member, and you had to do upkeep on your weapons. And that was a cool element to that game. Whereas with 40K or Fantasy, it's just a war game. There's not as much intricate detail to the figures themselves. I mean, just large squads of Marines or Orcs or, you know, whatever you're playing.
Okay. And then there was also Battlefleet Gothic.
Battlefleet Gothic was a space-borne game between the different spaceships of all the warring factions. And that was a pretty good game. That had a long run. The unfortunate thing with a lot of these smaller games is Games Workshop will put a lot of effort into them. They'll get them going, and then they kind of pull the carpet out from underneath you. A lot of these games are still available today directly from Games Workshop, but you won't find any of them in a game store. You can still buy Battlefleet Gothic. You can still buy Mordheim. You can still buy Necromunda, but you have to go directly through Games Workshop in order to get this stuff.
And then there's one, this is probably the one of all the Games Workshop games that interested me the most, and I've only ever seen pictures of it. Manowar?
Manowar, that was it was kind of a playoff of their epic scale games, but they were very, very small scale ships, sailing ships. This took place in the fantasy version of the game, and it had some interesting stuff to it. That stuff, unfortunately, is very difficult to find anymore.
Yeah, the only reason I know about it is because there's a user on Board Game Geek that's a Manowar player, and he's got galleries of photos of this thing.
Yeah, it was. I never got a chance to play that game, but I have seen the miniatures for it, and I have seen a lot of photography of it, and it seemed like an interesting game. But I never got a chance to play that one, and like I said, it's not available.
Okay, so that's kind of the overview of Games Workshop. Let's move on a bit here to a company called Battlefront Miniatures.
Battlefront Miniatures out of Auckland, New Zealand. They make the Flames of War World War II miniatures game. This is not quite company level. This is several squads. You'll have a couple squads of tanks, a couple squads of infantry that all take place in the World War II era. Its rule set is a little bit akin to what Warhammer 40K is, but it's done on a different scale, and it's all World War II. You have hand-to-hand combat and stuff against troops. You can assault tanks. You have buildings and terrain that come into play, and it plays out fairly well, too. But another prohibitive thing to that is the cost of it. And I don't mean to downplay the miniatures games because I keep saying they're expensive or cost prohibitive. They can be. The unfortunate thing is I think a lot of people go into a game store and say, I want to play this game. And the game store owner comes over, well, you need this, 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 this. You know, by the time he's done, you're dehydrated because you're trying to add all the stuff up in your head. The thing to do is to get a rule book or get a starter set that comes with a rule book and a couple of small starter armies and go from there. Get a feel for the game, play a couple games, and decide how much further you want to expand on it and decide whether or not you want to put that much time, effort, and, you know, most importantly, money into it and figure out if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, because I watched you guys play Flames of War quite a few times, and I think I even actually got into a game of it once, sadly against Walt.
I think I took you through a game or two as well. But
you might have, yeah. But it seemed nice enough to me. I mean, what I was doing made sense, but what the portion of the rules I was learning was only the portion that applied specifically to my particular squad.
Right.
And I could see where things were going to get a lot more complex if I'd gotten any further into it, and I was going to need a lot more stuff. I mean, I had, 12 or so various little tanks and jeeps and things, and I was going up against Walt's squad of tanks and more tanks and other tanks. and you know, it was all right, but I could see where the money was going to come into it. And yeah, I got to admit, for me, money is the big barrier for most of these, most of the non-collectible miniatures.
Yeah, and that's for me a lot in the miniatures gaming. I can get as much enjoyment out of building and detailing and painting the models as I can playing the game itself. And I know that's a prohibitive factor for some people. When you open up a Games Workshop book and you see the absolutely amazing paint jobs and detail that their house painters put into these things, and you sit down or you try and paint one, and it looks like a 3-year-old took a cotton swab and jabbed the eye sockets in on a Space Marine. You're like, it's just not, it doesn't compare. And that can really take the wind out of your sails. But you have to realize that the people that do that for a living have been doing it for years and years and years, and that's all they do. They practice that kind of stuff. And that's what it takes with any game. You've got to play the game. You've got to practice at it. You've got to become proficient with it and get better at it. So.
Right. And I will have to say, the painting portion of things is not as daunting to me as it used to be. And a large part of that is because of your former partner.
Yeah. I learned so much over the last couple of years working with Jason. He's just an amazing painter. And he makes it look so easy. That's what's frustrating, because I can sit down and work on a figure for an hour and, I'll be getting some things done, and, he can crank out an award-winning miniature and, go collect a trophy for it. So.
Yeah. Well, for those who might be listening to the cast who know about this sort of thing, just real briefly, like 30 seconds or less, tell me Jason's awards list.
Just off the top of my head, I know he has at least 8 Golden Demon trophies from the various Games Workshop painting events. I know he's won several more than that, but he really is an accomplished painter. It's amazing to see some of the work that he's done and some of the work that other people from around the world can do. It's really amazing when somebody really puts that much effort into it.
Yeah, he does an amazing job on all sorts of things. Okay, let's Flames of War we covered, World War II minis and all that stuff. Let's look at Privateer Press again really quickly. Because not only do they do Monster Apocalypse, the collectible pre-painted miniatures, they also do 2 of the non-collectible, probably more than 2, but 2 of the non-collectible kind, notably War Machine and Hordes.
Yeah, War Machine was their opening foray into the gaming world, if I remember correctly. And it took a while for it to become as popular as it has. In fact, it was shunned for quite a while in my gaming group. For whatever reason, people had heard bad press on it, didn't like the rules, or whatever it was. And one of the conventions that I went to, I actually watched a War Machine tournament being played. And it seemed like a different mindset of people that were playing that game compared to 40K or fantasy. And to be honest, they were a bunch of whiny little crybabies as far as I was concerned. And so that kind of put me off from the game, too.
So a room full of Larry.
Yeah. But one of the things that really drew me to the game was the models that were available, because War Machine takes place in, I guess you would call it a steampunk type of setting. They have these large animated war machines called Warjacks, 4 or 5 times the size of a human. They're run by steam and controlled by magic. And that alone was enough to catch my attention. I thought that was pretty cool. So I stuck my toe in the deep end of the pool and bought a couple of rule books and read through it and got to thinking, this could actually be a pretty cool game. And I finally convinced everybody else in the gaming group to play it, and, it caught on fire. I went from there, so.
Cool. And what about Hordes?
Hordes is a kind of a fantasy version of War Machine. Now, if you go back to, like, Warhammer Fantasy and Warhammer 40K, they kind of draw from some of the same ideologies as far as demons and monsters and things of that nature, but the two games are not directly compatible in any way, shape, or form. However, with War Machine and Hordes, the two games are directly compatible, take place in the same time frame, and you can play a War Machine army against a Hordes army. Now, whereas War Machine is all, steel lumbering warjacks, Hordes are all war beasts and animals, and you have warlocks that cast their spells and control the beasts. And, again, a very detailed game. Not terribly hard to learn, but very, very tactile in the application of it.
Okay. Well, and that's something I've noticed that a lot of companies don't do. If they produce multiple styles of miniature games, they don't tend to be very compatible with each other. So I think that's probably the most intriguing aspect of the Privateer Press games, is that Hordes and War Machine can both be played against each other together.
Yeah, and it makes for a very interesting game, because it's two very different styles of how you apply your play to the game. They're both a very headstrong, in-your-face type of game, but you've got two very different type of mechanics going on within it.
Okay. So the last one we want to cover, and this is kind of, this is right on the edge of being both a miniatures game and a full-blown war game, and that's Amarillo Design Bureau's Starfleet Battles. And this is set in the Star Trek universe, but not the Star Trek canon universe. Basically, Starfleet Battles takes off at some point in Trek history and goes a completely different direction from all the films and the movies and because those are two different things. Films and TV shows and books and whatnot. And it is starship on starship combat. And the rulebook for this thing can look quite daunting. It's
another phone book.
Yeah, it's another phone book. But the nice thing about this set of rules, and there's a lot of expansions for it, the nice thing about this set of rules is that you don't have to know every rule in the book. You really are only going to need to know the rules that apply specifically to the units you're using. And I think a lot of people get the impression they have to read the entire rule book to figure out what's going on and how to use everything. You don't. You really only need to read about a quarter of it to get the basic rules, and then whatever your ships are, the specific areas that are for your ships. Starfleet Battles tends to work on individual ships. So you'll have like an Excelsior class cruiser versus a Romulan Warbird. And those will be the only two units on the board. The tricky part of the game comes into the fact that you have to almost micromanage every system on the ship. You are asked to allocate power drawn from your warp engines or your battery storage or whatever to the various systems around the ship, like life support, torpedoes, phasers, shields, navigation, all this other stuff. It gets very detailed, and yet I find it still to be very easy to play. I don't know what your impression of it is, Andy. I know you like it, but beyond that, what do you think?
It seems for somebody who's watching you play the game, it can look very daunting, because each turn, like you say, you're allotting power. You're seeing what the warp engines are putting out. You're powering up shields or powering down shields. You're bringing your nav computer online, you're plotting a course for a torpedo, you're powering up port side phaser banks versus the starboard side, all of this stuff is going on, and each of these turns is, you know, represents only a couple of seconds in game time, but you do this throughout the entire game, and it's a little tedious to micromanage things like that, but it has a very fluid way of running through the game.
Yeah, I actually, in total contrariness to everything I've said about other miniature games so far in this cast, I actually like the fiddly bits of Starfleet Battles.
Yeah, it can be very interesting, especially, you know, when you've got rogue torpedoes roaming around out there and things of that nature. And one of the things that's nice about it, the rule book gives you a lot of references for, you know, it'll bring up something, it says reference this page here, and it'll take you right to it, and you can figure out what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And what do they figure the time frame on this thing is for a single game, one ship against one ship? Isn't it like 2 hours?
Probably closer to three, but it's hard to say. I guess it took us a little longer because we hadn't played it very much, but yeah, it's about, you know, an hour per ship on the
right.
table.
So if you had a third ship, figure 3 hours. If you had a fourth ship, figure 4 hours. If you had, you know, six ships, well, you're going to be there a while.
Yeah. And that's the only drawback I saw to the game, because I was hoping to have more ships out there to have bigger battles and have it be much more epic. Yeah. But when you come down to ship-to-ship battle, it becomes much more of a nail-biter, and trying to figure out what the other captain's going to do, what his next maneuver is going to be, whether his shields are down on that side or not, whether you can, you know, risk another torpedo run on him, you know, whether you're going to have the power to do it, and, you know, and put all this energy into your forward phasers and, you know, leave your shields down as you go screaming past him. So,
and frequently your answer to that question when playing against me is, no, you shouldn't.
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, Starfleet Battles, probably of all the games we've talked about so far, and I'm going to include Warhammer 40K and Warhammer Fantasy in this, Starfleet Battles is probably the most intense and the most detailed of the games we've talked about.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, it's odd because when you get into huge battles of Warhammer and you see all of the different types of troops and war machines, and you've got these huge elaborate special characters out there on the table. And like I say, when it's all set up, it really looks cool. It's just got a commanding presence on the table. And then when you drop down to like Starfleet Battles, you've got these two little ships floating around out in space, but it's the intensity of it is there. It's really great.
Yeah. This would be, if you're really looking to get into miniature games and you're really looking for something that's an experience in and of itself, I'm going to recommend Starfleet Battles.
Yeah, and right out of the box, now doesn't it come with the cardboard chits to play with?
Yeah, if you get the starter box, you've got the cardboard chits, you've got all the books you need, all the paperwork you need. Yeah.
And then you can buy the miniatures of the ships, because that's just that much cooler.
If I recall correctly, the starter box for Starfleet Battles is about $35 or $40.
Something like that, 45 at the outmost, yeah. I think.
And you get everything you need in that box to play the game as competitively as the next guy.
Right.
So, yeah, very nicely.
And one of the nice things about it, if you want to get into the miniatures, and this is something where you could collect all of the miniatures for it, you know, over a period of time, but I mean, you can get a box of miniatures with, I think it was 6 or 10 ships for maybe $40 or $50.
Yeah.
So it's not terribly expensive once you grind it down and think about it, because I mean you can buy a box set that has all of the major ships in it. You get the D7 class Klingon ship. You get the Warbird. You get the Enterprise. There was 3 or 4 other ships in there.
You get Romulans. You get Federation. You get Klingons. You get Kzinti. You get the Gorn. Yes, you get the. Do you get some Talosians? Tholians?
Tholians, yeah.
Yeah, Tholians. There's a lot of good stuff. And this is all this is all through Amarillo Design Bureau. You can get it right off of their website.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a neat little game.
Okay. I think that's going to wrap us up.
Do you think so?
I think so.
Well, Gamer Nation, that's what's out there, more or less. Hopefully you've heard about something that interests you, and we'd encourage you to check out those that have piqued your interest.
Yeah, take some time, look around, see what's out there. Use this as kind of a general pointer to what you might be interested in, what you think is kind of cool sounding or whatever. And by all means, take our advice with a grain of salt, because our experience is going to be way different than yours.
Oh yeah, always. And that's all it is. It's advice. I mean, it's obviously nothing set in stone. We don't know everything, even though we may claim to know everything. But
wait a minute, I thought I did know everything. Didn't I get?
Oh, that? You do. I don't.
Oh, that's right. Okay, I keep forgetting. Okay.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. What?
That would. Yeah.
On the table. Well, this is where we take a look at what Andy and I managed to play this week. Both individually and together.
Shut up.
you don't seem exactly thrilled with our choices this week.
Well, you know, we had one really cool game that I lost.
Mm-hmm.
And one really crappy game that I won.
Yeah. Let's talk about the one you lost first.
Okay.
I'm referring to this as the Wings of War Smackdown.
Well, you were flying Swiss cheese at the end. Who are you fooling?
Yeah, but see, I flew my Swiss cheese longer than you did.
Oh, okay. Yeah, mine was... Yeah. Mine wound up on the ground. And not with the wheels touching, so...
Yeah, we had Jake over. And
yeah, Jake didn't last too long. I think he still enjoyed the game, but I think we kind of beat up on him a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. It wasn't intentional. It wasn't like I focused on him or anything. I just shot at whoever was dumb enough to fly in front of me.
Yeah, well, that's usually what happens.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, and technically Wings of War is a miniatures game.
It is. It truly is.
Yeah, it's from Fantasy Flight Games. You're flying, depending on which version you buy, you're flying either World War I fighter airplanes or World War II fighter airplanes. And you have a series of maneuver cards that you lay out, and each turn you go through your maneuver cards, and they dictate where you fly to. And then you check your distance from the other guys with a little ruler, and if you're within the ruler distance, then you get to shoot at them. And in my case, you get to shoot at them a lot. And it's pretty cool. It was actually a pretty good. It was a pretty good battle. We did a lot of flying around the table.
Yeah, a lot of flying around the table. It was the only thing that we were missing was the Yakety Sax thing going on there.
Yeah. Well, it seems somewhere along the line in the 8 or 9 games of Wings of War we've played, Andy has learned that if you're behind me and I'm flying away from you, my next maneuver is pretty likely to be an Immelman. And it's not going to be a slow Immelman. It's going to be an Immelman, and I'm going to come out after you just as fast as I can.
I fell into that trap once again.
Yep. I tagged you a couple of times with that.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep. But, yes, I won, Gamer Nation. I am to winner.
Yeah, well, not before I shot down Jake and put several holes in you, but yeah.
It was funny. It was funny because I had a ton of damage cards. You get damage cards every time you take a hit, but most of mine were zero damage.
Yeah, you were flying more zeros than the Imperial Japanese Navy, so
yeah. It's a good thing that this game went so well, really.
It is, and this is one of those games where I don't think we've played a bad game of it too. So
yeah, it's another one. I'm always happy to have played, no matter whether I won or lost. Not that I've ever lost.
Shh.
Yeah, and another reason it's a good thing this was such a good game for us to play is because of the other game we played.
Oh yeah,
and I'm going to let you talk about that because you deserve to.
Do I have to?
Yes.
Okay, well, this other game, I mentioned it on the last podcast, said it was kind of like D&D, and, you know, you go in with your character, and you fight monsters and take the treasure, and...
It's kind of like D&D if you've never played D&D before, and you're trying to do it only based on some rumor you heard about D&D being mixed with chocolate milk.
Pretty much. Because I think at some point the Quick Bunny came out and flipped me off. Yeah, Traps and Treasure. It's not, well, it's a card game, but it, I don't know. I'm going to call it a turd because it needs to go lay in the yard. this was a really bad game. I would much rather play Munchkin than Traps and Treasures.
And that's saying something.
And it really is. Yeah. It was a bad game. It had no flavor to it. There was no real purpose to open up the deck of cards, and I blame myself for doing it.
Look, I put a card down and now you've taken it away from me and now I've gotten it back and oh, now you've taken it away from me again and now I've put it in the discard pile.
Yeah. The really great thing is I bought the upgrade deck for this game too. So
cool.
I've got that much more to throw in the fireplace.
Well, it'll be a warm winter then.
It will.
Yeah, that's all we got to play this week. And if it hadn't been for Wings of War, I don't think we'd have even done an on-the-table segment today.
We could have avoided it completely, but the Wings of War was a very good... It was a good game.
Yeah, that was our redemption.
I salute you, sir.
Yes, you should, too. Especially when you get that little parachute out. And it's funny.
Bye-bye, Andy. Going to the ground while I'm flying around.
Yeah, but see, the whole problem with that thing was is I got the coyote's parachute, and it was a backpack full of camping supplies, so yeah, it didn't work out so well.
Yeah.
Well, Gamer Nation, just like every week, the show has to come to an end sometime. I know you don't want us to go, and, well, the landlord does, so here it comes now. Before we go, though, I'm pretty sure there's something that we're forgetting.
Oh, yeah. The contest.
Indeed.
2 weeks ago, we asked you, Gamer Nation, to head over to our forums and tell us your best board game-related story. We got a lot of good entries, and frankly, more entries than we were expecting way back in episode 2. A whole lot more. So good on you, Gamer Nation. We are pleasantly surprised.
To begin with, Brian and I went through a detailed process of selection and elimination to find the best story out there. We hunted high, we hunted low, and there it was in the email. Carefully considered all the aspects of your stories, from the humorous to the sad, and the fish related. We read them all and thought, and then thought some more, and then, well, we fell asleep, because that much thinking makes us tired.
But while we were sleeping, the answer came to us as if in a dream. It wafted gently across fields of golden daisies, approaching ever closer, filling our senses with its delight. And then I realized Andy had been in the breeders again.
I shoot the gazebo. Still, we made a choice. And here it is.
Staker wrote, in college, my habits can basically be summed up as going to class part-time and skipping class the rest of the time because I was either hungover or my friends and I had stayed up all night gaming. We played everything, I mean everything, that crossed our table. AD&D, Star Wars, Star Trek, Tri-Tech, Shadowrun, Cyberpunk, Marvel Super Heroes, DC Heroes, The Morrow Project, Call of Cthulhu, Twilight 2000, GURPS, Teenagers from Outer Space, I had to take a breath, Toon, Warhammer Fantasy, and Vampire the Masquerade. And that was just the RPGs. We also played Hearts, Spades, Risk, Axis and Allies, Fortress America, Nuclear War and Nuclear Escalation, Car Wars, Car Wars the Card Game, Battletech, Warhammer, Warhammer 40K, Warhammer Epic, and Talisman. Talisman is where my funniest, most memorable board gaming moment comes in. One of our group purchased a used copy of Talisman, first or second edition, and quickly spent his food and beer money from his parents on all the expansions that were out at that moment. Talisman Dungeon, Talisman Timescape, Talisman City, Talisman Adventure, and the first expansion. He really likes to make lists.
He does.
Needless to say, when our group of typically 6 to 8 players played a game of Talisman, it was a very long, cutthroat affair. One such evening, most of us, being total bastards, decided to gang up on Gus, who is also a total bastard, and do unto him before he did unto us. You see, we always shuffled up all the character cards and drew them at random. Gus had drawn the monk, arguably one of the most powerful characters in the game, and we were all very afraid. So we quickly robbed him, attacked him, and did everything we could to eliminate him in the most expedited manner possible before he got too powerful. We succeeded. Sort of. We killed the monk, and he drew another character to start over while the rest of us were satisfactorily ahead of him. He drew the Astropath. Oh boy. Over the next several hours, he managed to get every item in the game that could help him. The chameleon suit, the rune sword, the wand, the hover sled? Whatever that thing is called that hauls equipment around other than the mule. And we tried to stop him. Oh yes, we tried. We failed. After about 6 long and grueling hours of Talisman, he made it through the inner region, and he moved his astropath to the deck of goodies at the center. He gave us all an eat, burp, sneer, rubbed his hands together greedily, and reached for the top card while muttering under his breath, Crown of Command, Crown of Command. He drew the horrible Black Void. The Horrible Black Void is the greatest F.U., where your character is lost in the dark void, never to return. Unless you're using Planescape, but we always opted to just say that if you drew the void at the top, you were dead. He smacked the card down in disgust, while the rest of us howled in laughter. He responded by pointing to each of us in turn around the board and saying, F you, to each of us. He chose not to continue with a new character. Which was just as well, for the next player, with the thief, managed to make it to the top in a couple of rounds, draw Pandora's box, and proceeded to destroy each of us in about 6 rounds. A very satisfying night of gaming for most of us. A very frustrating night for poor Gus. I love it.
They've got Gus. We've got Walt.
That's right. I love the story, so congratulations to Staker. You have been declared the winner.
You'll receive a copy of Fearsome Floors, designed by Friedman Freeze and produced in the USA by Rio Grande Games. All you need to do is send us your mailing address via gameon@d20radio.com, and we'll send it out to you via mail, or carrier pigeon, or hover sled, something of that nature. Once again, congratulations.
Well, Feedburner, our feed host, said we took a pretty major jump over last week's numbers. It might be due to going live on iTunes, but who knows how these things work. Anyhow, we're showing 48 subscribers as of Thursday, which is frankly awesome. Thank you very much, Gamer Nation, for subscribing. Loyal minions are the best. Tell your friends about us, and let's see how high we can make the numbers go.
Finally, remember, if you'd like to contact us, you can write to us at GameOn@d20radio.com. You can also log on to the D20 Radio forums at d20radio.com and leave us messages there. We enjoy hearing from all of the members of Gamer Nation and are more than happy to give out props on the show to those who earn them. Until next week, Gamer Nation,
Game on!
This podcast is intended for entertainment and educational purposes only. All specific names, titles, or products mentioned are copyrighted by the respective rights holders. Some sounds and music are provided courtesy of SoundSnap.com and Freesound.org. Reboot is copyright Alliance Entertainment. All original content of this podcast and its related website are intellectual property of Game On and D20 Radio. When did we write the show notes? Oh, yeah.
Well, I thought you were going to keep talking there. You know, there wasn't anything else there, but, you know, sometimes you just, you know, you run off.
No, go ahead.
But that's okay.
Starting time.
Starting time. Okay.
Right now.
Now?
Now.
Okay.